Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's go back to 2011 and look at the World Cup with Squidge. Let's go back to 2011 and look at the World Cup with Squidge.
Hello, and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective. And I think that is genuinely the first time I've got the name right. The first time I've managed to get it without putting the word rugby in there about six more times. This is a podcast which is good. Well done. You opened the right app and you made it this far. It is dedicated entirely to going back through the 2011 Rugby World Cup. And today we will be looking at a video game. It's not a video game.
You're doing so well.
Today we'll be looking at Final Fantasy VIII. No, it's Wales against South Africa. Wales against the Springboks. 16-17 it finished. And joining me today to talk about it as ever is...
pessimistic Wales fan Will Owen.
And also joining us today, our very special guest...
oh, hi. I'm Ali Stokes.
Yes, you are.
I'm the former journalist who now works in communications for Harlequins.
Yeah. So we had to, in order to get you on the podcast today, we had to get it approved by the CEO of Harlequins. Like, I think as Chris Robshaw himself had to step in and say, you're right, give you the go-ahead.
It's an interesting one. Because obviously before, you know, when you're a freelance journalist, you can kind of, you go and you do kind of whatever you want, really, in terms of media. But I think sort of working in a club, it was kind of something that you just have to run past to see how that works. But they're pretty cool at Harlequins. Ran it past them. They said, yeah, no, you want to talk about some more World Cup games? Go for it. You nerd.
That's Mike Brown all over, isn't it? I'm now taking everyone at the club is one of the players.
Mm. Mike Brown, yeah. It's funny, you know, I spent a fair bit of time talking to him recently. Mm. And I think, you know, people look and there's a certain assumption of Mike Brown, but you know, he's a really nice guy. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And we're doing a lot of work recently, and, I mean, with players, and obviously at the moment, There's so much going on in the world around coronavirus and people struggling and kind of Mike Brown's been one of the main people that's been kind of trying to raise funds for that. I mean, the guy has been giving away old kit and auctioning it off through in my locker for so there's a charity called CW Plus Rapid Response Fund. Yeah. And they're kind of raising money for the sort of local hospital to kind of, you know, Mike's and the Stoops area.
Mm.
And he's, you know, he's raised a couple of thousand for this, and it's, I thought, you know, pretty chill guy, pretty nice guy. I think
that's it.
What you learn, I think, when you start working with rugby players properly, is you realise that you can't really think you know their character by watching them and how they are on the pitch.
Yeah.
Because obviously they want to, you know, one minute you want to kick Mike Phillips' head in, and the next minute you're
you want to kick Mike Phillips' head in.
Well,
yeah.
probably wrong. Yeah, one moment you want to kick a Welshman's head in, I can understand that, and then the next minute you're a normal guy off the pitch, and it's funny, I think, you realise that these players are just...
I've always kind of assumed that this is a public persona, and it's interesting because I think some players don't put that on, and some players I've seen talk about how they struggle because people felt like they knew them. And there are some players who are very, and like Mike Phillips is actually a good example, who are very performative. And when they get onto the pitch, actually, they become a different person. And they kind of project that in the way like a stand-up comedian would. They'd go, okay, this is a version of myself that I'm projecting here. And I think it's a really interesting point and completely off the point of the game. And we're too early in to begin a long tangent. But if anyone has any thoughts, I'll open 40 seconds of discussion.
I also agree. I think Mike Brown is often quite misunderstood, and I've always got that impression that he's just very passionate to play for his country. And guess what? If that means standing up for his mates, then why do people have to then look at that and think, this guy's probably a dick? Admittedly, with the Mike Phillips example, I did see something the other day saying that when he was uncapped, he called Justin Marshall shit when he was playing against him. But, you know, says
he's had 81
caps
for the All Blacks at the same time. Yeah. And there's something as well, the last point on Mike Brown, but I don't think he'd be regarded in the same way and talked about in the same way if he wasn't kind of the token working class person in that England team.
Agreed.
And I think I've always had a real problem with the fact that Mike Brown was perceived as this kind of time bomb, really angry man, as the token working class player on the team. And then after he fades out, Kyle Sinclair comes in as kind of the token working class player. And he's shown in exactly the same light, less so in the last 6 months. But that was always something that has really bothered me as a point on actually
Genge
we talk about...
Too.
Yes, no, Genge, yeah. Genge, who is now going to revolutionise and change rugby forever, who is starting his own union. I also want to apologise quickly, because about a minute before we started recording, my neighbour suddenly started playing really loud bangers, and I can see the microphones picking them up when I'm not talking. So I hope you enjoy that. I hope you enjoy that house party going on, despite COVID-19 next door.
I think they're playing the same bangers as last time when they interrupted the podcast.
Oh, they seem to play them all the time. It's the same three notes of the same three songs. Yeah, it's like an Oasis album.
It feels like Trump logic that if you hit certain notes, the coronavirus can't survive.
It can't survive certain notes. We have talked for 5 minutes and we've not mentioned the game yet, which was fine when it was England against Argentina and it was a shite game. However, we should probably talk about the actual rugby match, because this, as I mentioned earlier, Wales against South Africa, and it was, I think, one of the best and certainly the best remembered games of the tournament.
Yeah, I think it's certainly the best so far of the ones that we've gone through in this catalogue that we're doing. In terms of, I want to say two superpowers of the game, but it's difficult because I think this is sort of the first time Wales sort of became a superpower in a sense. They looked like a real threat because in past, I was saying off air previously, I was kind of probably going into it assuming that Wales, as a Wales fan myself of course, would get battered by the Southern Hemisphere Giants. Rather than pushing them close, especially when Francois Steyn crossed literally 2 minutes into the game.
Yeah. And I think that is an interesting thing to touch on, the fact that Wales hadn't beaten a Southern Hemisphere team since Australia in 2008, and before that, I think it was Wales in 2005. I think they hadn't beaten the Springboks since 1999, and yet managed to push within a point of them.
Yeah. And there was that monkey was on their back the whole time. I feel like that was such a psychological barrier for the Welsh team to get over. And especially because there was a lot of young and experienced players coming to this team. And, you know, they all played well, but the likes of Rhys Priestland, Talupe Faletau at the time were very young and experienced, George North as well. And that pressure being on their shoulders was a bit of a barrier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's always a barrier when you put a 12-year-old on the wing, really. he was, I mean, you could, that was a young looking George North. I mean, he hasn't someone that looks like he's aged loads since then, but you forget just how young he was when he kind of really broke onto the scene.
Yeah. He was 19.
Yeah.
Which is to say, the opposite number is Brian Habana,
who he already scored once.
Yeah, it's your second time playing him. Good luck, lad.
Yeah.
So we had a kind of the old George North as well, the kind of the young dynamic one before any injuries came along. He looked dynamic. He looked, it's the agility for me, the little body movements, and it's actually the same with Jamie Roberts. He had this really powerful leg drive before he hit contact, whereas I think towards the sort of end of his world career, it was kind of the same speed when he got the ball, and maybe he decided to start faster because he was losing speed, you know, as you do when you hit your 30s. But it was just this athleticism when he would hit contact, and he would almost skip through gaps. And then he's so big that once he's got a half break, it's hard to bring him down. And it also helped that he was running at Mornay Stain all day, which was wonderful. But there was just it was a real throwback, and it was a kind of a. It made me feel like I was a 17-year-old college kid again, watching these guys that I grew up properly idolizing when I really got into rugby, kind of at their best. And throw Jonathan Davies in there, who's still the best, but he had a good game.
So is that your kind of memory of this game originally and of this World Cup? Of watching it in college?
Because actually I got so kind of plugged in with my college stuff and kind of little projects around it. Remember, this was one of the World Cup I didn't watch as much as I thought I wanted at the time. So a lot of this very much needed my memory jigging. And I think memories, to be honest, being, again, an arrogant, self-involved Englishman, my main memories from that World Cup is Tuilagi just running riot against Romania.
Romania, Georgia, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, of the non, apart from the final, of the non England games, yeah, this is the one. This is a classic. But it felt like I was watching it new. I couldn't remember any of the game. So watching it back, it just felt like a throwback.
Yeah.
It was awesome. And it's Thursday, so that's great.
It is Thursday, isn't it?
It is Thursday.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's either a Thursday, a Friday, a Saturday, a Sunday, a Monday, a Tuesday, or a Wednesday. And I'm not entirely sure.
I'm struggling with that.
Yeah. The good thing is, that's going to age really well, because whenever people are listening to this, they'll look at their watch and go, their watch or their phone or whatever, they check their days on and go, he's right. It was one of those days.
Yeah. It is a Thursday.
You've just given yourself away as a smartwatch user.
I just have I've not got it on at the minute, actually. That's weird. This is the first time in lockdown I've got used to not having a watch on. Normally I just stare at my wrist vacantly anyway and expect there to be digits, a bit like the Andrew Nichol film in Time. But yeah, no, I haven't. But normally it just says the date on it. That isn't interesting. Jamie Roberts.
So, Jamie Roberts.
No, I think also he was slightly slighter than he was, as you think of Jamie Roberts being. Like, he was far more agile, I'd say. He was kind of skipping into those tackles. And the lines he were picking were fantastic.
Yeah, and he had this lovely little step before contact that he used to do. And so I think this is Jamie Roberts more or less at his best at this point. Obviously, it was the 09 Lions is the one that people turn to. But this World Cup campaign, he was properly at his peak. And the way that little step before contact, and like Ali was saying a minute ago, the way that he managed to take that step sort of back in towards the 10 and carry them back and sort of catch him off guard, I think that was just Jamie Roberts at his best.
Mm. Absolutely. And he was also picking lines off people as well. In a way, I think as his career went on, he began to just pick lines into people. And he was going, okay, there's a bit of a gap next to whoever the 10 is. I'm going to charge at that. Whereas here, he was actively looking at who's taking the ball off. And there's that one break he makes off Faletau from an offload.
Yeah.
But also the way he was running off Priestland. The way Priestland was getting the most out of him, who was starting a 10. Because that was kind of the thing about, just to look at the rest of the Welsh team as well, that it was a few really interesting changes from what you'd have been expecting. Bold. From the typical Welsh team. So you had Rhys Preston coming in, who had two test starts, had just made his debut in the Six Nations that year off the bench, had only played because Stephen Jones rolled his ankle in a warm-up game.
Yeah.
And suddenly they're dropping him in at 10.
And I was so impressed at the time with Gatland in this selection, because I think typically I was one of these people who was guilty of thinking Gatland didn't really pick on form.
But yeah.
Stephen Jones was out of this injured, and I was really impressed with the ballsy pick to... Firstly, drop Lee Byrne, who was the only Welsh fullback in the last two decades to have come along. And secondly, make sure that he sticks with that call rather than switching Hook to 10 and putting Priestland on the bench. Starting Priestland, backing the youngster and putting Hook to fullback, I think it's a really ballsy but brilliant call.
You say that, though. I would have been more supportive of him dropping Lee Byrne if he hadn't put a Moose in at fullback.
Yeah, maybe not the best example of James Hook. In a Wales shirt, but...
Yeah, there were more... There's at least... There is one point in my notes where I just have the phrase, and I'm not entirely sure what it's referring to, in all caps, James Hook, you nonce. Because I shouted that out loud, and then realised that isn't good, but wrote it down anyway, because that felt important.
Was it the time when he was about 5 yards out from the touchline on an attacking line, and he just boots the ball like straight into touch on the full, and it goes like into the stands?
Yeah, there's that. There's another moment in which Butch James, who comes on quite early on, threads a little kick through in the 22, and James Hook goes to try and volley it, and like nothing good was coming of that. Instead, it just kind of ricochets off his boot and gives South Africa the line out. And there's so many moments like him missing kicks, him kind of...
Drop that ball for Franz Steyn's try.
Yeah, exactly. The first try comes from him, from a knock-on from him.
My main memory from this game of James Hook is watching him getting bumped off by Morne Steyn going for that try, while Shane Williams is desperately holding on to Steyn's ankles.
Mm.
He was just like, I don't know, I genuinely think Williams was the more effective one and he was kind of going for a ride. That's the only thing I think of. Having watched the game, I think back, that's my main memory of Hook in this game.
It's funny, so I've been playing a lot of Rugby 08 this week, just because, why not? Because I put the PS2 back into the TV, and I won the World Cup of Wales this morning. It's a Thursday.
Nice, congrats.
And it's funny, because playing as James Hook in it, I'm sort of thinking, you know what, I've been too harsh on James Hook. I've really given him a lot of a hard time, when actually he was a great player. And he was a really versatile player. and he was really solid and really good. And then I watched him play again, and that little bit of my brain just triggered. That little bit of, oh, he's not like people argue over, like, is his best position 10, 12, 13, 15. But I think the only compelling arguments are they 21, 22, or 23? Like, where are you putting him on the bench? Or are you even having him in the... It's just... Because he has all the attributes of a rugby player, of a really good rugby player, but he can't put them together. It's like looking at someone that's put all the pieces of a jigsaw in the right places, but they've just put them the wrong way round, so none of them connect. Like, if you turned every single piece round, the jigsaw is complete, but all of them are upside down, which would mean it's complete. So half of them are upside down.
He's one of those... That feels like a very Welsh thing, as an yes. Englishman. To have a player that can do so many things, but where do you play him? That feels very Welsh. And in a way, it's weird because you look at Australia and they do that. And for some reason, whenever Australia have these players that can play every position, they do every single one well, mostly.
Yeah.
James O'Connor at 10.
Yeah.
they all seem to work. And I don't know why Australia can always do it. Maybe it's just because their game is just so batshit crazy, it doesn't really matter.
Mm.
But It feels like a very Welsh thing to have.
Yeah. Do you want to hear something that's not very Welsh?
Sure.
Yes.
So the version of this game that's on YouTube has Georgian commentary.
Of course.
Which... Ali, did you watch that version?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. How did you find that as an experience?
I've realised I've never heard Georgian before and it doesn't sound anything like what I thought it did. At times, it sounded... Japanese, at times Italian. It didn't sound very European. Really,
I particularly enjoyed them really rolling their R's and saying like
"Rombies,"
like a kind of Rombies. Also, I watched this with my incredibly rugby deprived friend Alid, who wanted something to do, and so I did him a favour and said he could watch the game with me. And he pointed out to me that at one point, in the middle of a sentence, the Georgian commentator is saying something, and then they just blurt out the phrase "hospital pass" in English. Yeah. So I'm now
it's like when you've got the names. Yeah.
Oh,
so speaking of names, I heard them run through the Welsh team sheet. Because the way they talked about the teams was they didn't do the thing that like Miles Harrison or Nick Mullins does, where they kind of go, they pick up on the interesting ones. So like, you know, there's one change at 12 here, and you skip over the other centres and you move on, whatever. They just read out the team sheet, and they just read everyone out individually. And I want you to listen for when they get to number 10 in the Welsh team. Number 4 with James Roberts, and 3rd with Shane Williams, and they get the World Super Rugby's number 8 list.
Michael Phillips.
I love that they're cycling through the names of that Georgian team, and then they see, oh shit, lads. To be fair, actually, it is quite a difficult name if you're not familiar with our way of spelling it.
Michael. I love the Michael Phillips.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, he was also Warren Gatlandy, which
everybody had Ian in the name. I'm pretty sure at one point it was like Wilbertoni. There was Lidiati, I think it was. Lidiati or something.
They're a cult, the Lidiati. I know it's a Georgian tradition. It's a bit like Japanese where only certain sounds can be made at the end of a word. So they tend to add E or E on the end of basically everything. And I assume Georgian is the same. As you say, I know very little about the Georgian language.
As we've suddenly realised.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hospital pass, same in every language. And that word for hospital pass is ouch.
I learned that drop goal is not the same as hospital pass. And it just sounded like... it just sounded like they were... enjoying something a lot when Mornay Stain went for a drop goal. I'm not going to describe the sound. Listeners, you know what sound I thought he was making, and I kind of wish that was the reaction to every drop goal.
Oh, it's my reaction to every drop goal.
Yeah, it kind of caught me off guard. Okay,
you're particularly happy about this. So, to then just quickly pick up on the teams again, as I said, the Welsh team made a lot of changes. Luke Charteris as well at the time was seen as a big kind of upset of bringing him in over, what's his face, over Bradley Davis, who had a fantastic Six Nations. But actually, that Welsh pack was pretty much the standout thing. Charteris had a really good game. Alan Wynne, I thought, had a brilliant game, and I didn't remember that. And then they had that young back row of Dan Lydiot, Sam Warburton, and some guy called Tulupe Faletau, who, funnily enough, the Georgians didn't struggle with that much. They called him a completely different name first time, and then correct themselves to Faletau, and just got on with it.
And this was Colin Jarvis, were they?
Yeah.
This was, of course, Toby Faletau's first game without the Afro as well.
Yes.
Which is a very important factor in how well he played, as much as I miss the Afro, clearly. Mm. To be fair, I think there was a bit of like, conversation about whether it made him more aerodynamic or whatever.
Mm.
But, I mean, either way, that back row played brilliantly, not least Warburton, of course. And also, with the pack, the only change that the Welsh made in the entire game was Bradley Davis coming on for Alan Wynne-Jones.
Yes. I think Alan Wynne ran himself into the ground, and they kind of replaced that. And I was kind of going to get onto this later in the game, but I think that was a huge difference between the two teams. Because the Welsh team didn't look knackered, but they weren't fresh by the end of that.
Yeah,
they were a team that were fit enough to play 80 minutes, but that doesn't mean they have to play 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It felt a bit like Gatland making a statement for the sake of making a statement, rather than, and you know, for continuity and so on, but I get.
Yeah.
But Paul James was probably knackered by then.
Yeah.
And you look at that Francois Hugar try, he just can't cover the space.
Yeah. As you say, like it was, the Welsh team looked really, really fit. But naturally, even, you know, Mo Farah, 60 minutes into a game of rugby, won't be as fit or fresh as somebody who's just come onto the field.
Mo Farah won't be fresh 5 minutes after a game of rugby. But yes, I know exactly what you mean. You will have two separate Mo Farahs after 5 minutes of test. But yeah. I remember thinking for a long time about Gatland, and I think credit where it's due, I think can be, well, kind of reminds me of Eddie James in a way, can be very stubborn. But he did, down the line, he did stop doing this, but for a while, you know, he learned for a while. That always felt trademark Gatland to me, especially around that era. He just would keep these players on, he wouldn't bring on, it's like, he felt like he didn't trust his bench. And that's how I always viewed it. And I think kind of when you start reading the honest biographies and listening to the really honest press, in the really honest interviews and the press conferences, and kind of read between the lines and realise that it was more a case of, I want my best players in the pitch. And I wonder with Wales, that team was just such a classic team, down the line, not yet at the time. It was just a good team. It desperately wanted them on the pitch. And as you say, they were fit enough to get away with it.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, personally, I think obviously it was a one point difference. Spoiler alert, guys. For me, I thought Wales were really hard done by some of the refereeing decisions in the first half. I feel like, and on another day, there aren't many games where you say this, but I think the refereeing could have been the difference between the win and the loss. The Wales were good enough for me.
That's an interesting point, because I didn't massively look at refereeing decisions, but there was, of course, the big controversial James Hook decision where he took that kick at goal, and Wayne Barnes sort of signalled whether or not to go to the TMO. James Hook did the same thing back, doing a little box signal with their hands. And of course, one thing that this reminded me of is, Robbie, you'll definitely remember this, but the old Sam Our Captain song that was like the Welsh unofficial World Cup anthem. And of course, that had a verse in it which reads as follows. Wayne Barnes is a laughing stock. He's got a tiny little cock. James Hook asked him to go to TMO, but Barnsley said no. He can't do his job. We think he's a knob. But with Sam, our captain, we'll take the cup home to Sloop John B by the Beach Boys.
Very, very heavy unofficial imagery there, isn't it?
You are right. It's very unofficial.
My favourite thing was, though, that the Welsh squad became aware of that and started singing along to it. And they were joining in. Like, apparently it was Ken Owens got hold of it first and started showing the rest of the team. Because of course it was, hanging out on like Carmarthenshire Online, where this is being shared around.
It's right on Scarlet Fever.
Yeah. I bet Ken Owens is on Scarlet Fever.
I think Scott Williams' dad's on there. That's a fun fact.
Absolutely. Whereas he hasn't joined the Ospreys fan forum, or at least didn't before they removed it midway through the season, probably for tonal reasons.
Yeah.
On the refereeing thing, I noticed quite early on that, again, there's a lot of, and this happened a lot in this World Cup, of high tackles that are let go, or there's one early on where JP Peterson basically takes Shane's head off.
Right. And, like, right.
It looks like, you know when you've got a Lego figure that's attached, the head's attached too hard and you have to kind of wiggle it to try and get it off? It looked like he was doing that to Shane Williams. He was trying to rip his head off as calmly as possible. And especially because Shane is built a bit like a Lego minifigure. You know, he's got like the shoulders and the build of a minifig. Mm. And he had at the time that kind of haircut that looked like it was like dotted on top. But yeah, there was a lot of high tackles being let go.
Yeah. If you applied that to modern day, you'd end up with 13 versus 13. Like, because there's the kind of, you know, they're not necessarily high contact, and yet it hit the head.
Yeah.
You easily ended up with a lot of cards in this game.
So I decide to start counting, because I think there's a lot of, like, ruck entries in the side, and there are a few high tackles and so on. You just, you kind of go, well, the way Ray Games are refereed has changed since. But I'll just take a note of things that would be red cards nowadays. South Africa would have been down to 12 men at least, just from what I noticed. So, shock Berger at one point, Toby Faletau is being tackled by someone else, and Berger just drops a shoulder onto his head, kind of Sonny Bill in the Lion style.
Right.
No one noticed it, no one cares, and at that point the TMO couldn't step in for foul play, only in the act of scoring, so nothing happens. There's a point in which kind of, like, Mornay Steyn almost, like, choke slams Foxy. He kind of, like, grabs him.
Yeah,
like,
I saw that.
Yeah, and kind of throws him at the ground, which is one of those yellow cards you'd look at and could have been red. And then there's a moment in which Sam Warburton comes into the breakdown, and I think this is quite a famous one.
I noted this one.
Yeah, kind of is over the ball, completely got hold of it, turnover penalties given, and after the referee's whistle is blown, Johan Muller charges in and shoulders straight into Warburton's head, and Warburton then lies on the ground for a minute or two.
Proper cheap shot that was.
He just looks like, he doesn't look like he's concussed it, but it's one of those things where, you know when the door frame is a little bit too low?
Yeah.
It looks like he's had exactly that sensation. He bloody hurts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt for him. Yeah, that's one of the things on my notes, which sounds really sad.
Shall we, I've mentioned him, should we talk about Sam Warburton for a moment?
Always.
Always.
Always and forever.
My best and closest friend, of Samuel course, Kennedy Warburton.
So he made 20 tackles and 5.5 turnovers. I was going to say by my count. I saw the stats at the end that he made 20 tackles. I didn't count them. But yeah, there was one last turnover at the end which he got, and then basically Wales just got immediately turned over from the same breakdown, more or less. But all of those turnovers were at such key, crucial points of the game as well. Mm. Like, as soon as the Springboks started to get a bit of momentum or in a decent territorial position for Wales, suddenly he would win, like, a breakdown. And they're all penalties, more or less, as well.
Yeah.
So it was such a crucial thing.
That was kind of Warburton's thing, though, wasn't it? He lodged himself in the way so that you couldn't get there and you couldn't clear him out. So he won more penalties than he won, like, clean turnovers.
Yeah.
And there's also, like, you look at the stat, you mentioned the stats. His negative stats, if you will, the knock-ons, the penalties conceded, the tackles missed, are all zero across the board as well.
Of course.
Which is equally remarkable, the fact that he's managed to do all of that. He's been as evident on the game as he was. And yet, no mistakes, nothing, no blots on the copybook.
He's one of these guys where, I mean, towards the end of the career, people would say that, you know, he wasn't getting turners anymore. And he kind of admitted in his book that for him, the big thing was slowing the ball down.
Yeah.
He didn't. But yeah. I think at this time, in this game at least, he really was getting turnovers.
Yeah.
He was just an unreal pest. I remember kind of, there's a few games that stand out in the memory of Warburton. For me, it's any one of the Last Lion series in 2017, where he's just constantly slowing down the ball. He doesn't necessarily get it, but he's constantly slowing down. And this one, where he just keeps turning it over, and it's just so classic. And you would have think, with Hanek Brousseau, you would have thought he kept a bit just pilfering and pilfering, but it wasn't. It was Warburton. It was just wonderful, and Brousseau ended up being a tackle machine instead.
And there's a story I've heard about a South African fan saying to someone in a Welsh shirt, saying to a Welsh fan, as they were leaving the gates of this game, that I think your number 7 might be the best player I've ever seen. Of just him, this was kind of the game where he announced himself. You know, he'd come in the previous Six Nations against Italy over Martin Williams, and had kind of made that shirt his own over the course of about a year. But he'd made it his own in a kind of Welsh fans appreciate him sense, rather than a properly world rugby's going, oh, this guy's good, this guy's special. In the way he then became, he's now talked about in the air of the McCaws, the Pococks, the George Smiths of the world, of the great sevens of the professional era.
Mm. I think the biggest thing is that negotiation in the third test in 2017.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a lot of things you look back on and you think that was incredible. There aren't many things you look at the time and you think that was incredible. And that felt like just one of the standout captaincy moments I've ever watched live. And it remains that way, even looking back.
Yeah,
it was just... I can't describe it. It was just, he was so assured. And he's not, you know, we know he's not a particularly aggressive personality.
No.
It felt like he was an aggressive personality in that moment. And yeah, I mean, he will always stand out to me as one of the best captains in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was the thing Gatlin said at the time, that the reason he was Lions captain is because he was the best in the world at talking to the referee, especially now McCaw retired. And people at the time were complaining, like, oh, he isn't the inspirational talisman or whatever. And actually, that's not important. That guy would be in the team anyway. And it's the thing I always think about, like, Farrell with England. I don't think Farrell should be the captain for that reason, just because he's the best leader. And sometimes you don't want the best leader to be your captain. You want the guy that talks to the referee and the guy that does the difference of the captaincy, which is basically your role is the coin toss and it's talking to the referee. And Warburton was incredible. I assume he's really good at flipping a coin. But he was really, really good.
He always picked tails.
Yeah, the tails of Wales never fails.
Yeah. From what we were saying earlier, I guess with the whole Mike Brown thing, was that the way that people convert from their off-field personality to the way they charge themselves up on the field.
Yeah.
What reversed that penalty for Warburton with the Lions? I know we're a bit off topic here, but that was his off-field personality sort of showing, and the way that he deals with other human beings. And guess what? The referee is also a human being. You know, we have this game officiated by robots. And he always says that, like, it's a way of negotiating by being reasonable with them, understanding fair calls rather than, you know, debating every lost cause. And eventually, they know you have a case, which he did then.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than just overplaying your hand, rather than just shouting and getting on the referee's nerves. You stay calm, you talk to them when you need to. And he does actually, do you think later on in his career he would have appealed that penalty decision, the James Hook kick that wasn't given?
Probably, yeah. I think that's a fair call.
He would have seen it back once on the DVD and questioned it.
Yeah,
because it was inside his first five games as captain at senior level. He'd obviously captained his 20s and so on.
It's an interesting point.
Yeah, he hadn't captained the Blues. He captained Wales, I think. Yeah, four times maybe before this game. He just the Bar Bars game and then the three warm ups. Yeah.
Hmm, that's an interesting point. Actually, I'd never thought.
I could see it. Yeah, I'd be loath to say that he would. I don't believe that. I've never captained. It might surprise you. So I've never captained an international team. You know,
wait, what are you doing here? Sorry, when I appeared to Harlequins, I wanted Chris Upshaw. I wanted someone to talk about making decisions in key moments of World Cup games involving Wales.
No, I'm skating over that. I'd be reticent to say he would have done that. But yeah, you get the feeling he did just become much more forthright. And that moment in the Lions test. Felt like he probably wasn't at the point to be that forthright at the time. Yeah, I like to imagine he probably would have appealed it. I mean, watching it back, I forgot about this when I was watching the game. It wasn't until it happened I went, oh, it was this game. I still can't believe that. It was crazy. I was surprised there wasn't as much fuss made on the pitch as well, obviously.
Yeah.
It was like these days it would have been much more of a big deal on the pitch with the players.
Yeah, and it was something people talked about for ages afterwards. It kind of kept coming up as an excuse. It was a bit like the Reece Hodge tackle in the World Cup last year. These small moments that actually, they do have an impact on the game, but not quite as bigly as they're...
Bigly, I'm Donald Trump
bigly.
Now.
As they get blown up to be.
You know, they kind of... They get talked about a lot.
Because they sell a different chain of events, don't they? Because you don't know, the whole butterfly effect, isn't it? You don't know if they would have made different decisions, but I think you can never really say that if it was literally at the death, can't you? But it did feel... It did feel like a huge moment, such a close game, but it still blows my mind.
Mm. I think goal kicking was a big talking point of this whole tournament, to be fair, because the previous day, and the Georgian commentators did start talking about it, was the whole Rodriguez and Wilkinson thing from what was, I believe, only the day before. So, the game lasted four days. Finished.
Yeah,
exactly.
One of those kicks from Martin Rodriguez still sailing over the stadium.
But yeah, I feel like the... When it's somebody like ITV, they always need something that's away from just the regular analysis of rugby that they can just talk at lengths about, that they can make out as really controversial when it's not. So that was clearly it for this game.
That was the thing that kept coming up. But it does, it kind of leads me on to my point and my thought about Wales. I remember, Ali, actually, as we watched the Wales-England game this year in the Six Nations together, I remember as we were trying to find somewhere to watch it, And in the end, we ended up watching in purgatory, apparently. It was. Do you want to describe the pub we watched it in?
Yeah, the name has actually escaped me at the moment. Although it,
I think it was the William Webb Ellis or something.
It was.
Like that.
It was the William Webb Ellis. It was. It was. We were in purgatory because it was so rammed, and we were legging it from the England Wales women's game at the Stoop, and I was moaning because I'd given myself blisters in my new boots. But yeah, we managed to eventually. We found this pub. All right, this is it. It's so crowded, but we'll do it. And we were stuck between these traditional seating lines. Wedged between these two guys who kept forgetting that they had their table and we had ours. So I think we was turned into a shared situation. And it was like an invasion from the front of us where the people in the chairs was every time you go somewhere or you'd wait, they'd come back and they were a little bit closer. It reminded me of the statues in Doctor Who. Every time you blinked, everyone was a little bit closer to you. And we ended up so damn cozy by the end of it.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing about that pub is as well, the moment you walk through the door, there's a massive picture of Martin Johnson lifting the World Cup, just kind of emblazoned over a full wall, which kind of set up for me, walking in as one of the like 10 Wales fans in the building, set up what was to come, is watching it in kind of very cosy. I was also just wearing like a normal shirt rather than a Wales shirt, which felt odd to be watching an international
not in red.
And I felt like I wasn't properly, because I don't have an accent as well, I felt like, how do I properly communicate that I didn't enjoy Anthony Watson scoring?
You need to stand up on the tables and start shouting, clap my pooking, go, 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 go.
You're showing off. You're showing off.
I'll just stand up and shout, Murpha.
Yeah,
because that's the closest I can do.
Bring back Neath or something like that. The regions are a joke.
Pontypridd!
Sonny Parker was so underrated.
Yeah. I tell you what, having played Rugby 08 this week, he was. But there was a point you made in as we were walking along in which I mentioned that I felt 2019 was kind of the great mischance for Wales in terms of winning a World Cup. And you'd said something like you felt 2011 perhaps was instead.
Yeah, I mean, because again, I remember being distraught on behalf of Wales for that red card, the Warburton red card. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. I sat on on the living room floor of my mate's house. I was watching it, his dad and their mates on the sofas, and we were just watching. And I've never felt so passionate about a decision against another team, another country. And it always felt to me like you look at the way the All Blacks played in the final and kind of the way France played in the final, the method of play as opposed to whether they were battle line. I feel like it would have suited this Welsh team brilliantly. And for me, it always felt like Wales were robbed that year. I always felt like that was, even though they didn't make it to the final, I felt like they were worthy finalists. But I can't like think of my mind as finalists in 2011, even though I know they didn't go that far.
And I want to, before I dive on to... Well, how do you feel on the same topic of was this Welsh team good enough to have won it?
It's a funny thing because I think it's slightly dampened by the fact that I think the 2019 team is now the one that I look back at and think that's the one that got away. So I think that's weirdly made me cope with watching back 2011 a bit better. Admittedly, I'm not looking forward to eventually doing a Wales-France match, an episode for this. But it's a funny thing though because I can just about deal with this because I wasn't expecting this Wales team to do that as well as it did. So it was a bit of a shock at the time.
Because, okay, so I've always felt this Wales team wasn't mentally strong enough to win a World Cup. And I always felt like they weren't going to do it. And if it wasn't for the red card was perfect because it gave Wales an out and it gave them an excuse and it gave them something to be angry about. Because this team wasn't mature enough to win a World Cup in the way the 2019 team was. And the 2019 team wasn't as talented a 15 of players, I don't think. Certainly not by the time they had the amount of injuries they did by the quarters and semi-finals.
Yeah.
But they did have this ability to win, and they understood how to win tie games in a way this team didn't. And you look at this particular match, and actually, A, they shouldn't have really conceded that try to Francois Hogar. There was a couple of mistakes in the lead-up, and then you get to the actual try itself. Is really simple once South Africa worked a few phases, and Shane Williams completely runs straight past the ruck and just lets Hogarth go straight through, who is at the time kind of his opposite number. lets him just go straight in under the posts, and he leaves Paul James covering about 7 or 8 yards, which Paul James has just played 65 minutes. He's not going to make it.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it a thing that legend has it that Faure de Pruyer calls to Francois Hojard, like, in 3 phases time, you're supposed to run this arcing line outside me, which they'd run on quite a lot during the game, but he called that 3 or 4 phases in advance, which is, I just can't think of another scrum half in history, arguably, other than Faure de Pruyer, who could have called that so accurately that they'd catch a Welsh guard out of place and find a bit of a gap.
Yeah. So this is the thing. I thought Faure de Pruyer was phenomenal.
He was the reason why I won that game for me.
Yeah. This was the other thought I had, was that if Wales had Faure de Pruyer, they would have won the World Cup. And I don't think, even if the red card was given, Faure de Pruyer in that Welsh team, and they win the World Cup. Because Mike Phillips was, bless him, he was good at what he did, but he wasn't smart enough.
He
didn't have the game understanding. He didn't have the intellect at all. Like, he had the kind of the grace and decorum and intellect of Boris Johnson in a go-kart. Like, he was just kind of like fumbling around and bumbling forwards. And he just like, I almost knocked over my glass of water there. I'm animated. But there's this thing that happened a lot in this World Cup where, because Conor Murray was first coming through, and people were comparing Phillips a lot to Conor Murray. And you watch Phillips play in this game, and he doesn't have the vision, he doesn't have the intellect, he doesn't have the game understanding, he doesn't have an ounce of what Murray saw when he watched a rugby match. It's like comparing Dan Carter to an otter, because they've both kind of got fur on some parts of their body. It's a single brain organism, single cell organism, being compared to someone that's actually a talented, good international rugby player. Because Phillips just wasn't wired up properly. He couldn't see space, and when he could, he wanted to go for it for himself. He wasn't. There's a moment in not long after that try where basically exactly the same thing happens, that one of these South African defenders overshoots, and George North then spots it and comes running this really hard line, and if Phillips gives him the ball, there's like a 70-30 chance North's going under the post, because it's about 10 metres out, and so Phillips picks up, waits a second, and just runs into a defender himself, because he spots the gap himself, and that's all he can think to do. He isn't thinking about the players around him, because the only thing his brain's connected to is the optic nerve. It's connected to his eyes, so that he can kind of look up and see either a defender or a McDonald's bouncer just charge heads first into them. And it's just kind of like, I realise I'm going off on one, but I felt like Mike Phillips was a good player at what he did. He was big, he was physical, he was all that. But he didn't have the intellect you needed in a team, especially this inexperience. And with a 10 like Phillips, yes, he had lots of caps, Mike Phillips, by this point. He probably had 50-ish caps plus. But he just couldn't think.
Yeah.
And one of my notes from this game is that Mike Phillips was an animal. And it reminded me almost of, because he was not carrying, he was tackling. He physically, like you say, he was outstanding. That's not necessarily what you want in the scrum half. And it reminds me of one of Billy Twelvetree's last few games for England, when he came off the bench and he was so clearly desperate and so clearly wanted that jersey so badly that it was like he came on as a back row and he was just smashing things. His blonde hair was just flying everywhere. I might have been Eddie Butler saying that. I think the line was Billy Twelvetree's looks like a man possessed. Because he was just going. And I kind of, what Mike Phillips reminded me of there, he was just
going. Peter Steph, the trees.
Going. Yeah, talk as Peter Steph, to go toys. Did you look every time John de Villiers went to contact and mistake him? too early. Yeah, it happened less to extent when Scott Berger, when his hair wasn't flying.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, my brain says, to toy. What? No, that's not right. That's not right.
Big, tall lad with wavy blonde hair in a South African jersey. No, I can completely see that. Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'll also just quickly add that I am going back to Mike Phillips. I was always typically like the most anti Mike Phillips person in history, and like I've always been obsessed with the idea of, you know, decently quick ball, which he didn't bring. Obviously Tavis Noyles on the bench here, who isn't really experienced enough to bring him on at all at this point. And of course, leading into this World Cup, there was the whole incident with Rob Howley falling out with Dwayne Peel and pretending that he was injured, and then Dwayne Peel saying, "No, I'm not injured," and Rob Howley going, shut up, go away," sort of thing. And I can just remember this whole time thinking, like, oh, if only I had Dwayne Peel to come off the bench and bring a bit of energy and so on. And the one time that somebody injected a bit of pace from any sort of standstill to Wales was Shane Williams.
Shane comes in at nine.
And does a great quick tap and makes about 20 yards off Warburton turnover. And there were so many times in this game where Shane would come in at 9, 10, 15, wherever he was in the line, he would make so much space. All the space Wales found in this game, other than from kicking, was via Shane.
Basically, they wanted the full back line of Shane's.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, Shane can kick goals. That's fine. I've seen Shane drop goals. I've seen him kick goals. Shane can do everything. Let's put Shane, it's 14 Shanes and Adam Jones. That's my team. That's my dream Welsh team.
Shane Williams is, I think, the guy that really made me fall in love with rugby. I'm watching him again. Again, one of my other notes is just I forgot quite how much of a wizard he was. And I think Cheslin Colby is the closest we've come to anything like him since. And even now, I don't think it's just the things, is the acceleration he had, the way he'd suddenly get away from people, and the giants he would fell was just wonderful. I just forgot how incredible he was and why he made me properly fall in love with rugby.
Yeah.
It was so, so good to watch a full game of him again. Because you remember, most of his games were highlight reels. There was just much of it. Wonderful player.
And there's this thing that doesn't
come up. But looking at the lineup, I forgot how short he was.
Yes. Yeah. There's this thing as well that doesn't come up on his highlight reels, which is how often he came in at 10 and just made space for other people. And there's a few Jamie Roberts carries, which are him kind of dropping off to him because everyone's watching Shane and knowing he could go in any direction at any moment. And you've got three defenders just watching him, and suddenly, bam, there's the biggest man in Wales charging at you.
Yeah, there's one point when he gives the ball twice to Alan Wynne-Jones, sort of stood on the wing, where he pops up to 10. And there's one in particular where he sort of gets the ball, feints to step one way, then does sort of a double step to his left, leaves two people in his wake, and then gives the ball to a completely static Alan Wynne, who's not really sure how to read this line. And Alan Wynne's kind of inadvertently made a line break just because Shane's made that much space for him.
Yeah. Oh, he was fantastic. And he had a complete all-round game as well, in a way not many wingers genuinely do. And when you talk about wingers having an all-round game, they tend to mean they can take a high ball, they can finish, and they can do one specialist skill. So in Shane's case, it'd be finishing. In North's case, it'd be bouncing people off. Or Lomu's case, you know. Actually, Shane could do everything. Shane could have operated as a 10 or 12. Maybe not a 12 in this era, but a 12 in the 70s he could have worked as. Yeah. I will just then dip back to the point I was beginning to make before, I was kind of making before on the, when I went on a rant about Mike Phillips. But I just don't think, is it this Wales team basically only had one player with that, and I know what I just said about Shane, with the kind of game management and rugby intellect in Priestland, too, and you could have brought in Stephen Jones when he's fit. But it didn't have the intellect to try and work around things, and so you actually saw, after that Francois Hugo try, Wales get into the 22 three times, which I'd forgotten, and James Hook misses a penalty. Rhys Priestland misses a drop goal from directly between the posts. Like, he strikes it. It's an awful drop goal attempt.
I know.
And they then have another chance where they just get turned over and lose the ball. And South Africa only get back down, you know, in that final quarter, they get into the Welsh 22 twice. They score a try through Francois Hugo to put them back ahead and to win the game. And then they get down there and they spend 3 minutes in possession and they run the clock down, so Wales only have 15 seconds when they turn it over, in which to try and do something by the time they win the scrum. And the sheer difference between the teams and their ability to do that, and it's partly Mornay Steyn being actually a really calm, collected fly off, and mostly just Fory Dupria being absolutely phenomenal and reading the game in a way very... It's, you know, like we talked a few times about how players have got better and players have got smarter over the last 10 years. Foy Dupree is playing like a player from 2046. Like, yeah. He is 30 years ahead of where we are now, never mind when he was actually playing 10 years ago.
Quick maths.
He would completely, completely dominate at any level of rugby right up for the next 15 years, I reckon, at least.
I think that South Africa getting into 22 in that second half, I think it comes back again to Wales not having the replacements to stand toe-to-toe. And you look at Derek Albert coming on, you look at all the other, just you look at though, Bismarck, Duplessis came on. Yeah. They just, South Africa is such a big country, and actually, aside from New Zealand, because they are just, they're just an anomaly in being a small nation, but unreal in every single person that plays rugby there. South Africa, kind of like, they kind of remind me of Wales, because they just, that is that love. There's that unreal passion for rugby, but they are just so much bigger. There's so many more chances to come across big people who play rugby well. And I think that's just what happened on that day. They had the people, the faith in the bench to bring on the power. And like you say, Hugard comes on, you know, and does his thing, you know, behind a pretty fresh pack.
Yeah.
I think, again, that was a big thing.
They also way ahead of, I mean, actually, whenever they cut the coach's box, I was very aware of one man sat almost out of shot, who is a Mr. Johan Erasmus, better known by his nickname Razzy. I'm always fascinated by when he became known as Razzy rather than Johan, because I've been back to watch clips of him playing and everyone refers to him as Johan Erasmus. But somewhere along the way, his name, his Wikipedia page, his everything becomes Razzy. His name officially becomes, I wonder when he changed that, when he put the depot application.
Snazzy Razzy, maybe, I don't know. He had a particularly good karaoke night on the team social, and that was it.
Jazzy Erasmus.
That's so much better than mine.
So you look at the bench, actually, and back when we only had 6-man benches rather than 7, they had 2 props, a hooker, and a second row on the bench. They did a 5-2 split before, obviously, it was a 6-2 split. And they kind of had that bomb squad idea going 8 years ahead, and you can wager that was the responsibility of their special consultant, Mr. Erasmus.
Yeah, they didn't bring on Van der Linde, mind you. They only used 3 of the bomb squad back when it was a 4-man contingent.
Also, like, that South Africa bench are all impact players. You know, they're all someone who'll come on and do something different, other than Brock James. No, Butch James, sorry, who was playing.
I always do that.
Yeah, I did that earlier.
Other than Brock James, who comes on to sell gloves to everyone else. But, no, Butch James is kind of there in the role Franz Dane was, because he can play 12, 10 and fullback, and he's got a massive boot. And actually, the rest of the bench are impact players. So Hugo's there, he comes on the wing, he scores the winning try, and they bring him on because, as well as covering scrum half, he's able to cover the wing and he hits good lines. And then Muller, very different second row to the two they had starting. They have Steinkamp and Bismarck, who are, again, different players and come on and change the game. And that, it's not the case of the Welsh team, where that bench is just shitter versions of the players who were starting.
Yeah.
Mike Phillips is shit, but no, Tavis Noyle is a shit Mike Phillips. And the only player you look at, Bradley Davis is a case of, he's about as good as Luke Charteris. So he's kind of the exception.
And Halfpenny as well, but he's not really an impact player, is he?
No. And then Andy Powell is the only player you'd look at and go, actually, he's probably an impact player. He'd change something when he came on. He'd kind of try and change.
Just realised I called him Derek Alberts as well. Sorry.
That's okay.
Ryan Bevan, I guess, is a different type of player, but that's why they don't bring him on, because he couldn't cope with the scrum.
Yeah, he'd got eaten alive by Gianni Duplessis.
And he's only in because Geoffrey Jenkins is injured.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of that bench and that decision-making late on is, it wasn't good enough, and Wales had 3 chances to win the game late on, and they didn't take any of them, and South Africa kept handing them chances as well. There's enough, you know, that there's the case in which Priest and Fred's this lovely grubber through, and Francais is just waiting for it to go into touch.
Yes, and pushed out.
Yeah, James Hook just comes and shoves him, so he knocks the ball into touch, and Wales get the line out 5 metres out, which eventually leads to the Faletau try.
Yeah, I'd like to quickly touch on Priestland's kicking for the corner and stuff.
Yes.
I think because it's such a difficult task playing against 2 Staines who are booting the ball miles over your heads all the time. But the way Priestland kicked was just all about space, rather than necessarily about having a big boot or anything. And quite often, he would manage to buy that extra second on the chase. There was the very early one where Faletau managed to make Foy Dupree and knock the ball on. And there was another one where Stain sliced a kick, Mornay Stain this was, sliced a kick return. And there were so many opportunities like that where Parisa managed to find space in the 22, especially one where Franz Steen sort of had to back to keep the ball in, then fumbled it behind his try line a bit. Still managed to knock it back about 50 yards, but it's one thing, it was such a threatening kicking game, and Parisa had a great game. It was such a shame about missing that sitter of a drop goal at the end.
Yeah. So there's a point I wrote down as well, because I did at a certain point change to the ITV commentary. I did go and find that.
Coward.
Because there was something about it. Not only was the commentary in Georgian, but you could hear Grant Nisbet's commentary in the background.
Yeah.
And so it just sounds like two blokes talking over the game. It sounds like two annoying blokes in the pub talking really loudly in Georgian and struggling to pronounce Priestland. So when I put
There's a joke in there about being an Englishman in a Welsh pub.
Yeah. You walk in and everyone
now
starts
you know
speaking
how we
Georgian.
Feel.
Yeah. When you're in Wales and they will start talking Georgian. You walk in and bloody Faletau and his family start speaking Tongan. I've got 2 points on Mars Harrison. One on the kicking thing you're saying, and it was the start of that very Gatland kicking strategy they employed for a few years, where they would kick for space. They would kick for it to stay in field, so the fullback and the wing would be kind of contorted into weird positions, and they just kind of have the ball lie there, and they'd have to kick it back, and they then hopefully get a net gain from it. And that worked quite a lot often. But there's 2 points in which Nick Mullins goes, well, that's just kind of a nothing kick, where that's, you know, there's no point in that. And I kind of get it, because at that point, you were so used to seeing the Dan Parks, Ronan O'Gara kick for the corners, and see someone do something radically different to that repeatedly probably felt like he was just a bad attempt at it, when actually it was a really interesting new tactic that was being kind of unveiled for the world in this World Cup. And the other phrase I wrote down was something Nick Mullin said on the brink of half time, where he said, there's a contented burble going around the cake tin. Which,
good name for a band.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah. It's not my favourite preserve, the contented burble. You know, it's not, I wouldn't normally put it on my toast, but, and also because he said around the cake tin, it sounds like it's kind of been trapped there. So yeah, I just wanted to bring up the phrase, contented burble. Again,
thank you,
could have come up in a geography paper.
Yeah.
That stream's a bit of a contented burble. Does anyone else have anything else?
I'm going to read out my list of notes, my bullet points.
I like it.
It's just, they've been... So, one, I forgot how tall Mike Phillips was. Two, I forgot how small Shane Williams was. It's nice to see the middle version of Franz Steen again.
Yes. Like, Franz Steen post... Yeah. Like, post being the youngest player to play in a World Cup final and all of that.
It's but middle stage.
Pies. Yeah.
There's been so many different versions of Franz Steen. It was just nice to see this particular one again.
Yeah,
little,
I want
the little
like
mustache.
An evolution of man with Franz Steen and gradually wider. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, yeah. When I pause it at one point when he's celebrating the try, you can see just the fledgling shadow of the belly. This is the first thing made its debut that day.
When he's doing that evolution of man, they're increasingly far apart as well, like because of his, the size of his boot. Like he's booted the next one on.
Slowly
to
moving
the next
to France.
Country.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's one moment as well, just to pick up on the Franz Steen thing, where Franz Steen is takes a high ball and calls the mark, and George North comes in and hits him after he's called the mark, and he's furious, and he dummies kicking the ball at North's head, and then kind of just out of sheer anger, and like, I'm Franz Steen, this will hurt. This will be your first concussion, George, get used to it.
Yeah.
And then when he does, kind of when North's walked away, he then boots it right into the Welsh 22 from his own 22 in a moment of like, I'm so angry, I'm completely tempered to use a Welsh word.
And George North was 8 years old at that point as well. He could have died.
You're picking on the smallest kid in the playground, except he's built like George North. Yeah. Sorry, your notes.
No, I think these are... I like this. If we can keep going on tangents, I will provide the stupid note.
Please.
And you add the info.
This is the form of it.
So Pierre Spies looked like he was growing in a lab.
Yes. Yeah, he was a player who had all the attributes and should have been world class. And yet it never quite happened, but probably because he was born in a lab and kind of just dropped off at the age of 19 in the under-20s, rather than actually growing up playing minis rugby, developing skills.
He looked like he'd been cast in a superhero film. He's just had these weirdly perfect dimensions.
Yeah.
That people will spend a lot of time trying to achieve. Somehow he got them.
Jacques Freeze's sidekick.
Yeah. Is there like a fat version of Pierce Spees who starred in the sitcom before?
In a sitcom?
Yeah, in a sitcom, and he lost all that weight to be in a Marvel movie. And he built himself into this.
Oh, okay.
So it's like Chris Pratt, but
that's it, exactly. It's Chris. Yeah. I'm with you there. Yeah,
but he's in that kind of, as you say, it's properly Marvel movie proportions, isn't it?
Mm.
He's really he's weird. Built like an Avenger.
Almost. This film podcast going well, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I haven't mentioned any foreign language films today.
No, not yet.
The Happiest Day in Life,
we've already
finished
agreed from, that you are the professor from Money Heist. So
I take it well. I am slightly less handsome and slightly Spanish version. Next note, come on.
Blackberry on advertisement boards, a sign of the times.
Oh. Wow. Yeah.
There's a throwback.
That's so 2011.
That very much is.
It really set the scene.
I did watch a few of the adverts post-match when they kind of the game immediately finished, and it came up with a thing saying, next Friday, the Star Wars saga on Blu-ray for the first time.
Oh my god.
Which, sign of the times, that's what you could have been doing during that World Cup. You could have gone to see Friends with Benefits at the cinema, and you could have watched the Star Wars collection on Blu-ray for the first time.
Or listen to moves like Jagger on repeat.
Yeah. Welcome to 2011, people. It only gets better from here until 2012, at which point call
Duck
it
sauce,
off.
Yeah.
Oh, I've forgotten about that song.
Mm.
That was the lowest quality needed to require being a banger.
Mm.
Debatable.
That was like sat teetering on the brink. Of actually, when I think back, I probably didn't like it at the time, but looking back on it, solid.
I think that's where Pitbull set the bar. That's where he went from.
Pitbull set no bars.
Okay, fair enough. The man rhymed Kodak with Kodak.
Exactly. Pitbull only set the bar for mafia men turned pop stars.
Wait, is that true?
No, it's just... could be. Like, no one's allowed to mention it.
I believe you. It's a rumour that started here.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's dive on it.
This is how it starts.
There are 13 people at the bottom of a canal, thanks to Pitbull. any more notes? And are they about Pitbull?
I want to make a new one up that is about Pitbull, but
cool,
that would be forcing it.
Please
no,
do.
Okay. I'm going
to
work him into my last one.
Okay, I like it.
Drop Girls are in fashion, but
yes.
Really bad. And I bet Pitbull was good at Drop Girls.
Oh, I bet he was.
Mostly because his head looked like a ball. I had to work him in there. He's in there.
Pitbull ripping his own head off like Shane Williams and JP Peterson to drop it down. Boot it over. I can't imagine Pitbull going for a drop goal.
Me
I don't
neither.
Know why. For me, hard carrier.
I've just got this image of Pitbull sat in the pocket organising his forwards in front of him. Saying, no, you need to be there. I need my blocker in place. I've just got this image of Pitbull trying to organise that.
Mr. Worldwide!
Mr. Spread It Wide, yeah.
Oh! That's very good.
Every other move would be Fireball, yeah.
Pitbull, to me, if he was a rugby player, would be the kind of 12 you had about this period where Jamie Roberts and Mon Honor had happened, and you just picked a big fat lad who couldn't pass and stuck him at 12. That's the kind of player Pitbull would have been.
He looked kind of like Sterling Mortlock, so it works.
That's it. He looked a bit like Sterling Mortlock, so they tried to pass him up. They put him straight into the USA team in this kind of pre-Lasique, who incidentally, say hello to, I don't know, just realised he's... Yeah,
get into that song.
Yeah, get him to write a song with Pitbull.
Have you
get
seen
the two
his
collab?
You've seen his singing, right?
Yeah.
It's
he's incredible.
Insane.
Yeah,
also,
he's incredible.
Genuinely
also Sarah Beckett as well. Yes.
Yeah.
Between Paul Lasique and Sarah Beckett, we have some unbelievable singing talent at Quinn's.
Yeah.
I had no idea. So we put out the Paul Lasique videos, and then some of the women's players messaged me and said, get Beckett on. Mm. So it is. Would you mind singing a song? And we'll put it on social media. And she came out singing Jolene and blew my mind.
I saw it. It's really good.
I've not seen it properly.
You'd be impressed if you heard it in a lounge or something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to find it now. Professional rugby players, man, they can do it all. And I can't do anything. And
they can do it all. They adopt different personalities. They're surprisingly nice people.
I write the theme tune, sing the theme tune.
Craft services.
Yeah. Okay, okay.
It's obviously a very strange time at the moment for everyone. The guys have asked me to share a song, so I can't promise it's going to be good, but I will share one. So, here goes.
Oh, that's when it says Instagram. Click to keep watching. I'll stop there because we could go on for ages, but
that's incredible.
She is insane.
Hey everyone, oh God, Sarah playing again.
One more song.
But I don't want to hear it a second time. No, it's just stunning. Just the vocals on her and the TK were just brilliant. So if anyone else wants to listen, head to the Harlequin social media channels. Pitbull, follow, Pitbull, like.
Pitbull, if you're listening.
He's always on. He's always on. Off. Professional. Stoked,
no, honestly,
man.
It was. You could make an album of the CK and Beckett songs, and I picked that on repeat.
Featuring Pitbull.
Featuring Pitbull.
Pitbull, Joe Marla, done. Yeah. You've got the whole gang out.
I'd love to get Joe Marla to sing this song.
The closest I can do to a segue is Jolene Muller coming off the bench.
That's
the best I've got. It's not. Don't flatter me. I don't deserve it.
I quit this podcast.
I wouldn't blame you. Have you got anything else? Any other notes written down? Or was that your last one?
No, that was my last note. The drop goals, which we didn't actually talk about, the drop goals.
Yes.
No, yeah, that was my last note. Everything else is just like actual things that happened in the game. Oh, hang on. This is quite... Okay, I've got one in 43 minutes. It says, James Ends Roberts. I'm getting confused between the Brock and the... Brock James?
Butch James.
Butch James, it really surprised me. He absolutely ended Jamie Roberts at one point, which is amazing, considering how Roberts were playing. And Butch James was, 31 at the time or something? He ended him. Kind of blindsided both Roberts and me.
Yeah, and it was with the drop goals as well. Like, I love drop goals, and they kind of come round every World Cup. I said this, that's come to Ben James of Wales Online quite recently. Of like, they seem to reappear every World Cup, and I love that. And I love that there were three drop goal attempts. I'm less fond of the fact all of them were missed, and two of them were from basically halfway. But again, that just to quickly touch on it, that Priestson drop goal really bothers me because a team should be slotting that.
Yeah,
and if Priestson doesn't fancy it, or Priestson's going to hit it like that, you've got Hook as well. You've got a second kicking option.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just there's that, and there's also that lovely break where Faletau goes and offloads to Roberts, and they knock it on 5 minutes
that
out of the line.
Me. Yeah,
I know, and that was the moment. Like, if Wales score there, they're under the posts. They're already 6 up. They're then 13 up, which is a huge lead for 50 minutes ago. Even against the world champions, even against as well organised a team that's got literally Foyd Aprea at 9.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think it's that moment, and then moments later, there's another break where Jonathan Davis goes through, and they had to finish one of those two while they had that momentum, and they didn't, and they didn't take the points when they're on offer with the 3-pointer attempts.
Yeah,
it's just strange because you see, like. I spent a bit of time seeing training for various reasons throughout various different careers. At one point I was training to be a strength and conditioning coach, you see players doing drop goals all the time.
Yeah.
In training, and they nail it. And like the most obscure players doing it, I saw Matt Garvey standing on the touchline in line with the sticks, drop goal, curve it through and around. It was like,
wow.
It was honestly like the thing these players do. But I think the point I'm trying to make is. That Matt Garvey should play by heart. The point I'm trying to make is that it's just a kind of indication of what the pressure in these games do.
Yeah.
In these situations, these people who can do unreal things by our standards, speaking for myself, there's the pressure. It's a reminder again of how hard it is to do what you're good at in front of such big crowds.
That's exactly my point about this Welsh team. And I guess I'll probably end up touching on it when we get on to the semi-final eventually. But they weren't able to deal with that pressure, and that was the difference between them and the South African team, and that was the difference. And if they had made that final, they had luckily, you know, if Stephen Jones or Hoppe had got one of those two kicks late on in that quarter, that's semi-final, I don't think they would have won the final because they didn't know how to deal with that pressure in the way the All Blacks just about did.
Yeah,
and even France did, and the South African team definitely didn't. They won a World Cup off it before that, And it's just, this was the problem with this Wales team, is they, I don't think they were mature enough because they couldn't deal with that pressure. And that's kind of my lasting thing I took away from this game, was I felt almost quite angry about it, because they just, they weren't mature enough. And if they could have, yeah, eventually they build into it by 2019, but it takes 8 years for this team to get into a position, or maybe 7 years. It takes them until pretty much 2017, 2018, until they get into a place in which they're able to start winning those tight games.
Yeah.
On against anything more than Scotland.
Yeah. As I say, it's a bit of a mental barrier, isn't it?
Yeah.
Having that maturity. And like at this point, like even Jonathan Davis, who, as we touched on, had a great game. He was still quite young at this point. You know, and now he's the vice captain. Like, it's a big jump. Now he's the person, you know, he was what, man of the tour in a Drawing Lions series in New Zealand. Like, that's a hell of a jump. And it's, I guess, testament to him now for being the sort of person who does close games out. I know that closing games out, you think if you're 9 and you're 10, but you know, you need everybody else to follow them up, don't you? And he's exactly that sort of player you want. As you say, like, that 6 or 7 years is a big difference for this team to mature.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, I think we've rambled quite a lot. We've gone on quite a long time at this point.
We have, yeah.
Shall we move on to our man of the match and our dick of the day?
Yeah.
William Rees-Owen, do you want to begin?
Sure. Should we start with man of the match?
Yeah, let's start with man of the match.
Okay. Well, controversial decisions all around, I'm sure. But I'll start with a few of the nominated players. I think Scott Berger, Mornay Steyn were brilliant South Africa. Mm. Forward Apriya was... just, as I said, we touched on earlier, he's the reason why they won that game, and they didn't give in to any of the pressure that Wales put on them. Was Fory Dupria just completely batting it back all the time. I'm afraid I'm going to give it to a Welsh player. Priestland was great, Shane was great, Jamie Roberts was great, and also, I want to say, I'm not going to give it to this guy, but Hugh Bennett had the best game I've ever seen him play.
Yes, absolutely. Hugh Bennett was fantastic. And he'd been on a really poor bunch of form in the Six Nations of the Ospreys that year. And he suddenly, out of nowhere, had this brilliant game. And it was, as I said, maybe the best game he played in his life. It was, during this tournament, was the best form of his life.
Yeah.
And he was fantastic.
Matthew Rees and Richard Hibbold were both ruled out of this tournament. Yeah. And I had zero faith in Bennett whatsoever to be, like, even, like, of a decent standard at this point. And he really, really played up to it. And now I reflect on Bennett as a really good player. And as I say, this is the best game I ever saw him play. And I'm not quite going to give him man of the match, because this is one of the best games I ever saw Sam Warburton play, and I saw him play a hell of a lot of good games at top levels. But as I say, like, so many tackles, so many turnovers, all at key moments of the game, leading the team as a young man. He was, what, 23 at this point. I can't not give it to him.
Yeah. Ali?
My brother, that's... it's... Fory Dupria is a good one. I want to give it to Sam Warburton, but I think that's just me being incredibly biased, because I love the man.
we all do.
I think you can't not pick Fory Dupria. He was just so the archetypal mastermind scrum half. He was typical him. It's really hard. I mean, that Butch James hit on Roberts makes me want to... Did I say bright one? I said bright one. But I want to also want to pick Jamie Roberts, because I think he was absolutely wonderful and he was just an absolute bashing ram. But you've got to... really, I think, the mixture of the brawn and the brains, South Africa... they had the muscle, but Fory Dupria was the brains that made the edge, I think.
Yeah. Makes sense.
I think the smartest scrum half I've ever seen, to be honest.
Yeah. And I had a similar thing. I remember before we started doing this, I remember thinking about this game and thinking I was just going to, like, instead of saying, oh, who's going to be man of the match, I was just going to assume we were going to say Sam Warburton. And actually, having watched the game I was really gutted to say my man of the match is Fory Dupria. I thought Fory Dupria was the best player on the pitch. And Sam Warburton was a close second, and I thought Sam was fantastic. And Faletau as well. And also, Alan Wynne-Jones was incredible.
He's great.
He was absolutely everywhere. And Charteris had a very good game as well.
Yeah.
I remember at the time that being more notable, because you didn't expect Charteris to have the level of game he did. Whereas Alan Wynne-Jones...
dynamic, wasn't he? They need to redo it. There was such a tall guy in that game, he was quite dynamic.
Yeah.
It's worth saying that we are probably bigging up a lot of the Welsh players quite a lot here.
Yeah.
South Africa won the game. But that's the thing. I think that the South Africa as a collective played to a slightly higher standard than Wales did, hence them winning the game. Whereas Wales had a lot of players who were playing sort of 8 or 9 out of 10 games. You know, I'd say Hugh Bennett probably...
Yeah. I think where we're looking is we're talking about the big positions. I think at 9, South Africa had it. At 10, relatively easily matched. But I think Mornay Steyn wins that by a distance. Because some of his attacking moves, I think the hand for the France Steyn try was surprisingly quick for him.
Brilliant, yeah.
I think it's the crucial areas. Like Wales didn't play badly, but South Africa had the edge. They matched the brawn and they had a bit more brain on the day.
Yeah, yeah. Monty Staines is a criminally underrated attacking player, I think.
Yeah.
Because his kicking overshadows it, and his handling and his sidestepping and stuff is generally very well rounded. Yeah.
And like, when I look through the South African team now, the only players I'm looking at going, oh, they had a legitimately good game rather than a fine performance, are the two Staines, you know, the Wales should have used some Daz to get rid of them, and then Schalkberger, maybe Heinrich Rousseau actually as well.
Yeah.
But I'm, oh, and then obviously the heart, obviously. Freud Aprea. Whereas everyone in the Welsh team you're looking at going, actually, they had a pretty standout game. Like, Adam Jones won a few penalties against that Springbok pack, and Paul James as well. They're both kind of there to do the stuff in the tight. Mike Phillips is an idiot, but otherwise, like, North had a really good game, actually, which I didn't remember him being that involved.
Yeah,
but just he would turn up and take off loads, and he'd turn up and be in support quite a lot.
Turnover,
I think he
said,
yeah, at the start about his agility as well. And in both the centres, the entire Welsh team, that back row, we haven't mentioned Dan Lidia's name once, I think. Mm. And yet, he was fantastic. Faletau was brilliant. Both second rows, excellent. Whereas the South African team were just doing their job. And actually, because they were a smarter team, they were better at doing it. And that came through and they won it with fewer standout performances.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure if it was a tactic, but there was a lot of honeypotting around the ruck sometimes. Mm. And I'm one of the people I don't like saying, look, they got distracted, they let themselves get distracted by honeypotting, because often it's a decision.
Yeah.
It's something they're executing for a very good reason. But there was a lot of that going on, and I wonder whether it just wasn't the right tactic. It wasn't every single one, but there seemed like it was tactical swarming.
Yeah.
And it just didn't... It felt like a game to shut down South Africa.
Yeah.
Instead of a game to really do stuff. And they did stuff going forward, but it wasn't particularly creative. It was effective Jonathan Davies, Jamie Roberts stuff. It didn't feel like there was enough smart Fury de Pria level things.
No.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's just knowing your resources and knowing your scrum half will be Mike Phillips, because your other options are either Lloyd Williams, who has one cap, or Tavis Noyle, who is Tavis Noyle. And again, like, people have kind of forgotten Tavis Noyle or the anecdotes about him shaving off his eyebrows on the way into training by mistake because he was sleeping in his car. And stuff like that, you know, but he was...
Accidentally shave off eyebrows?
I don't know, but I remember him telling the story of how he was sleeping in his car and he woke up and he'd shave part of his eyebrow. So he went, I'm going to commit and shave them all off. So he did that. And then he went, well, I haven't got anything else. And he tried to draw them on in mascara, but obviously he was going into rugby training. So he sweated a lot and he just ended up with this just like black face covered in mascara that had trickled down his entire face. That was the kind of guy Tavis Noyle was, and he was the scrum half that wasn't Mike Phillips. And I've only told you what I thought of Mike Phillips' intellect. Those are Wales' options at nine.
The point of context that really ruins that is I can remember an interview with Tavis Noyle where he said his least favourite part of playing nine is bossing the forwards around because they're not very bright.
Yes, I do remember that. I don't know if Foy Dupree had a doctorate, but he kind of looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I remember that film. You know that film, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days? Like, how to lose your pack in 10 seconds. Say that.
I could talk about the film, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, sorry, Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson, but I won't. I'll move on to Dick of the Day. Does anyone have any contenders that aren't James Hook? Because mine is James Hook, and it's James Hook because of repeated incidents, including the one I mentioned where he just kind of kicks the ball into touch, trying to volley it, which wouldn't have worked anyway. Him missing the stuff, him knocking the first high ball on.
There's a point I forgot to mention from my notes that Rivoli was reminded me of. There was a moment where Fran Steyn sent a monster grubber downfield. We're talking 60 metres. Shane Williams saunters up.
Yes!
Judo chops it with his foot midair, catches it and saunters onwards, sprinting forwards.
Yeah.
And he was just like, this needs more attention.
Yeah, there's no replay of it. There's no slow motion. And like Lionel Boxeast did that once, and Sky showed it on behind the cup coverage for 3 years.
Simon Zero did it, and he won the Lions Tour.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Show the man some respect. Like, honestly, it blew my mind. I watched it, and I kind of stopped. I was like, well, I'm going back. Thank you, YouTube 10-second skip. But it was wonderful. And it kind of, again, it reminded me that I want him back. Yeah.
I miss him. I miss him desperately. Did I mention I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago?
Let's move on.
Yeah,
you did.
I interviewed Shane Williams a couple of weeks ago. But it's fine, we don't need to talk about it. I interviewed Brian Habana this week, that was cool. He's a really, really nice man. Anyway, Dick
I missed the Shane Williams one. We were talking after the show. That one went past me.
Yeah, I kind of rambled at him for a long time. I just kind of, I got slightly nervous because at one point I started speaking and I realized I didn't know my next question. And I just talked about how much I loved him accidentally for about 5 minutes. And he kind of had a moment in which it kind of clicked in his face. I was like, oh, it's one of those interviews. He's one of those people. And he just kind of went with like, yeah, you know, it's good. If I've inspired anyone, that's appreciated. And he was really lovely about it. He was really nice about it. But there was like, there was clearly a, oh, he's a proper card-carrying fanboy look of like, it wasn't negative. He was really nice about it. But at the same time, it's the one of these interviews I've done for World Rugby where I've kind of lost my cool slightly and been a bit fanboyish.
I think you did very well, actually, given the circumstances, because I would have totally given in straight away and just started fanboying. So, yeah.
I love you.
I kept it up for about 2 minutes, which is professional.
Yeah, still immensely jealous. But Dick of the Day, should we carry on?
Yes.
Hook, again, more so for the weird kick out on the fall out of hand than the volley, because I think the volley was actually under a bit of pressure, so I can kind of forgive him a little bit. But I'm going to give, and usually I give Dick of the Day for something that's quite tongue-in-cheek or something quite funny, but I'm going to give it to Mike Phillips, because he got turned over twice in the last 10 minutes from being slow and just not getting the ball out. And like, he was the person who was turned over in the last play of the match for Florida Prayer to kick the ball out, just because he was just faffing around, and I'm not sure what he was waiting for.
No, if he was faffing around, he would have got the ball out quickly. If he was faffing clerking around.
Oh, I'm going to shoot you. Anyway.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Anyway, socially distant, of course. Anyway, make sure if you're committing a murder tonight, make sure you do it from a social distance.
That is the main priority when not stabbing someone, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, anyway, giving it to Mike Phillips for generally being a bit annoying throughout most of the game. Albeit sometimes he does something positive and that's fine. And this was one of his more positive campaigns where I hated him less. But as I say, like the way that he got turned over twice in the last 10 minutes when Wales just needed to just do something slightly outlandish, it just felt unforgivable. As much as Priest and missing between the post is also something that's also unforgivable. But yeah, Mike Phillips.
And Ali?
Mine's going for my deep hatred of anyone that decides to harm Sam Warburton. And Muller gets my Dick of the Day for the shoulder charge on the top of your head, like you've just walked into a low-bearing ceiling hold from Warburton. That's my Dick of the Day. Muller.
Very cool. That's a very good call. Okay. Yeah. That finally, I realise this has been quite a long one, that finally brings us through today's Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective, which I got right for a second time in the space of only 4 hours or however long we've been talking about how great Sam Warburton / Fourier Prior are. Thank you very much for joining us, Ali. Is there anything you want to plug, anything you want to mention, anything you want to get in before we finish?
Thanks for having me on. It's been quite fun. I've enjoyed it. You put up with me. Well done, you. No, I mean, maybe if I plug anything, I'll be an advocate for the women's game. I think having someone who was entirely plugged in, lived and breathed, worked, earned, you know, put food in my mouth and paid my bills with men's rugby, having really stepped into the women's game now with Harlequins, that's my usual job is being full time with the women's game, and I've taken on some more responsibilities while this situation is on. Mm. The women's game really is full of some incredible people. Coaches, players, their stories are wonderful. I'm not just going to lobby Quinns, I'm going to lobby all the Tyrrells teams in particular, the Six Nations. Just if you've not really been plugged into the women's game, check out some Tyrrell stuff. Honestly, it's more expansive than I think people would imagine. They've got some real skills. What I'll do is, if anyone's out there that hasn't really given the women's game a go, check it out. Soon we're going to be streaming the Leinster Harlequins women's game on the Women's channel. So give that a watch if you've not watched a game before. But yeah, just give it a go. Women's game is something that I never appreciated as much as I should have done. And now I'm into it. It's just full of incredible people doing fantastic things.
I'm definitely going to tune into that now you mentioned that. I've only really watched the Women's Six Nations before, and so I think watching Tyrrells is good advice. So I'm going to take that on board. So thank you. I'd also like to also extend my thanks for you coming on and doing this and putting up with this. So thank you again.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
All right. Well, brilliant. Thank you very much, Ali. Thank you very much, whoever the other person is. No thanks to myself. And thank you very much
for
listening.
The guy who said he'll shoot me.
Yeah. Van Keep is keeping 2 meters apart so I don't get the coronavirus as I die.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll call it there. Thank you very much. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.